Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the KRFY Morning Show here on 88.5 FM. I'm Phil Huff, and along with co-host Julie Calamine.
Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Julie. We wish you all a good morning. Today, we're going to be talking about the Pacific Northwest Trail, from vision to reality. And our guests in the studio are Brad Smith, North Idaho Director for Idaho Conservation League and a Pacific Northwest Trail Advisory Committee member.
Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Brad. Matt McGrath, the Pacific Northwest National Scenic Trail Program Manager from the Forest Service.
Good morning, Phil.
Morning, Matt. And Stephanie Campbell, Regional Coordinator in Montana Region and Pacific Northwest Trail Association from Whitefish, Montana.
Thanks for having me.
But before we get to talking about the Pacific Northwest Trail, we're going to talk about the wonderful spring weather we're having.
Well, all right, Phil, it's a great hiking day. Today, we will have mostly sunny weather with a high of 62. Tonight, it will be partly cloudy with a low of 38. And tomorrow, Friday, mostly sunny with a high of 64. So back to the program.
It sounds like wonderful hiking weather.
Oh, you know, one other thing that I should mention is that on this day in 1933, we had the establishment of the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC. Kind of appropriate for our talk today.
A lot of our trails were built by the CCC, and sections of the Pacific Northwest Trail might have been. But what we're going to talk about today is how the Pacific Northwest Trail was first envisioned, how it's being built, and where it's headed to the future. To start with, though, it'd be nice to have an overview of what is the Pacific Northwest Trail for someone listening who's never heard those words before.
Phil, the Pacific Northwest National Scenic Trail is a 1,200-mile route from the Continental Divide in Montana to the Pacific Ocean. It was first proposed in the early 1970s by a gentleman named Ron Strickland, and the idea developed from there. And in 2009, it was added to the National Trail System by Congress. We now have 11 National Scenic Trails. Pacific Crest, Appalachian, Continental Divide are the famous ones. And then we have some lesser-known ones like the Pacific Northwest Trail.
Excellent. And so in 2009, with the congressional designation, what changed? What happened then?
Well, when Congress designates a National Scenic Trail, it changes from a series of trail segments to one long linear unit. So it directs the Forest Service to work with partners and other federal agencies to provide an outstanding trail experience from one end to the other.
So the agency that manages the trail, the Forest Service, then has resources to bring someone like you on to coordinate those activities and management plans?
Yes. The PNT travels through quite a few jurisdictions. The Forest Service is the largest, about half the trails on Forest Service land. Also Park Service, BLM, a lot of state and private partners. And so that's really the big part of my job, is working with all those folks to get everybody working together.
And how many national forests does it cross?
PNT goes through 7 national forests in 2 regions of the Forest Service.
Very nice. And you mentioned partners. So who are some of those partners? We have one in the room today, I think. Stephanie?
Yeah. So the Pacific Northwest Trail Association is who I work with. And we are the primary partner with the Forest Service in the promotion and protection of the trail. So we serve the trail experience. We try and work closely with the Forest Service on that.
So the trail right now, you could walk all of it, but part of it's built. What's that like? Can you kind of literally walk us through what that experience might look like?
Sure. The trail, you know, you can do a 1,200-mile trip from one end to the other. Right now, as part of the challenge with the long-distance trail is to provide that end-to-end experience. It currently uses about 300 miles of roads. So that's one of the big challenges for us in working together to get the trail off of those roads. For the most part, there's a lot of great sections of trail. There are also some old sections of trail that not a lot of folks have used that have been added to this as part of the National Scenic Trail. So that's one of the big challenges, is roads and kind of lost trail sections.
So how do we move from that vision and the scattershot today it is to something that's complete?
Kind of the big project that the Forest Service is embarking on is a comprehensive plan for the trail. That's one of the requirements of Congress when the trail is designated. Mm-hmm. And that's the big project we're working on with these partner organizations and other agencies.
So to do that, I understand there's an advisory committee. And perhaps Brad could speak to that advisory committee, what its role is, how it's doing its work.
Yeah, so the legislation that established the Pacific Northwest Trail also authorized the Secretary of Agriculture to appoint an advisory council to advise the Forest Service and the federal partners about various management issues related to the trail. So, you know, how we'll manage the trail corridor for the recreational experience, how we'll deal with other resource issues on the federal lands that the trail passes through. So, for example, in our neck of the woods, we have two populations of grizzly bears that are listed under the Endangered Species Act, and the biggest threat to those populations is human-caused mortality. So we've got to figure out how we manage this trail corridor in a way that provides for the recreational experience while limiting the impact on grizzly bears.
What are some of the other concerns that the committee is addressing? Communities, an overarching vision for the trail?
Yeah, so far we've had just one advisory council meeting, but it seemed like at the first meeting, and of course Matt and Stephanie could give their take as well, it seemed like at the first meeting there was a lot of discussion about how various communities along the trail corridor could benefit from this. In our area, Bonner's Ferry is the key example. The trail currently goes just north of Bonner's Ferry, and Bonner's Ferry is a logical point along the trail for hikers to stop and resupply their food, wash their gear, spend a night in a hotel, and then continue on.
Mm-hmm. So through hikers, folks who might want to do the whole trail end to end, it's a great resting place. But for some of us local people, and I would dare say a lot of people listening here might be wondering, well, how do I get some of this? What's the experience like, and what's the opportunity for local hikers?
Well, you know, the current route uses many of the trails that local people hike and recreate on. So up near Bonner's Ferry, the current route goes through the Purcell Mountains. It uses a system of trails, actually, that are open to dirt bikes and four-wheelers, and I understand that there's some concern there about potential recreational conflicts, so there may be some adjustments to the route in order to put hikers on a trail through the Purcells that eliminates that conflict. And then over in the Selkirk, going up the Parker Ridge, very, very scenic part of the Selkirks that is popular to area hikers. It's one of my favorite parts of the Selkirks. As some of the listeners know, there was a fire up on Parker Ridge this year, and so hikers that venture out on the PNT this year will have to take alternate routes through Long Canyon or up Trout Creek, but very, very scenic part of the Selkirks. And then over in the Priest Lake area, after you cross the Selkirk Crest, the route follows the trail on the north side of Upper Priest Lake, which is a very, very scenic area, and then continues on up to the Samuel Priest Wilderness in northeast Washington.
So if you're just tuning in, this is 88.5 KRFY, the morning show with hosts Phil Huff and Julie Calamine. And in the studio today, we have guests here, Matt McGrath with the Forest Service, Brad Smith with the Advisory Committee to the Pacific Northwest Trail, and Stephanie Campbell from the Pacific Northwest Trail Association. And we're talking about the Pacific Northwest Trail.
Yes, we are. And I had a quick question for one of the three of you. If a hiker who's not a thru hiker wanted to access the trail, what's the easiest way to find our access points? Do we go online? What do we do, you guys?
So right now the trail is, we're kind of saying there's the recommended route that we have on the PNT.org website, and there are strip maps that you can find there. And so if you really, you know, that'll really get down to where you can get in, and you have to kind of match those up with, like, you know, a Google map or something to understand kind of where you come in, because they're really zoomed in. But if you go and look at the strip maps, you can find, you know, your area and access that way. There's also there's going to be more information coming out as we move through the process. That's going to be put up on, like, you know, the Forest Service websites about the trail and So it'll be a little bit more accessible as we go forward. But like Brad was saying, we're still kind of determining the route in this area and of where it's going to eventually be, though we do have the route that we recommend people use right now. So that's the strip maps on pnt.org would be a great resource.
Okay.
So the advisory committee, route selections through North Idaho and some of the challenges, what are some of the other challenges along the way, other portions of the trail that might be considered for other alternative plannings or routes?
Well, I can speak specifically to the section through Idaho, and then maybe Matt can address some of the other segments in Montana and Washington. But I mentioned earlier, Phil, the current route going through the Purcells here in northern Idaho, and that route through the Purcells utilizes a system of motorized trails. And certainly, I think there's an interest in relocating that section of the trail in order to avoid the conflicts. As a hiker personally, I would want to be on a route that doesn't have dirt bike and four-wheeler use. And I think, too, that some of the guys that have been at some of the meetings representing the motorized recreation community are potentially concerned that if the route stays as is, that section could be closed to their use, because under the National Scenic Trails Act, this is supposed to be managed predominantly for non-motorized use. So perhaps for different reasons, I think there is a mutual interest between hikers and motorized users in relocating that section. Then when you cross over into the Selkirks, the current route, after you go up Parker Ridge, crosses the Selkirks. There's about a five-mile stretch across the crest where the trail actually doesn't exist. So it's a long bushwhack over the crest through some pretty gnarly terrain. I've heard the trails person at Bonner's Ferry, Pat Hart, she uses a classic phrase. She calls it a meafy hellhole. Hopefully that's appropriate for the radio. But people, after they cross over the crest, they're usually so tired that they don't even continue up to Lookout Mountain. They just go right down to Lion's Head Campground for a break and a camp out for the night. So those are really the two sections that I think in Idaho need to be looked at. Not only does the section across the Selkirks not exist, but that also goes right through the prime grizzly bear habitat we have in the Selkirks. And so the advisory committee and some of the other public participants are looking at what are some potentially alternative routes that the Forest Service might consider.
Yeah, I think Brad definitely got the local issues right. Along the length of the trail, a big challenge is the amount of motorized routes used to piece together this non-motorized trail. There are a lot, especially in eastern Washington, long open stretches of road. Many of them are forest roads, kind of sleepy, quiet forest roads that aren't the worst experience when you're looking for a non-motorized trail. But we also have some sections of highway where the trail is on the shoulder of a highway, which obviously is not really compatible with any kind of recreational hiking experience. So getting the trail off of those areas is a priority. Also, another challenge is working off of federal land. About 80% of the trail is on federal land, but then working with partners right here in northern Idaho after the trail goes through the Selkirks, winds up on state land, state trust land managed to benefit public schools. So how do we provide a quality national scenic trail experience in an area that is by law managed for timber harvest to benefit the school system?
And are there areas where it crosses private land?
There are a few areas of private land, especially in western Washington, some large timber companies. So it's almost a very similar situation to the state trust lands. Very few individual landowners along the PNT, but mostly large commercial landowners.
It's also worth noting locally that at the bottom of Parker Ridge, where the trail goes up, there's a section of private land that the trailhead is on where the Forest Service actually doesn't have a legal right-of-way in. Fortunately, use has been allowed to continue thus far, but attempts to secure a right-of-way have been unsuccessful.
And you all mentioned that the decision-makers and the trail route are an advisory committee, and I think I heard mention of the public. Is there a way for the public to have input on where the trail will be going?
There definitely is. We have an email address specifically for the public to comment. It is pnnstcomments@fs.fed.us, short for Pacific Northwest National Scenic Trail. And then folks will have the opportunity to comment at any time. Another great way is to work through their local advisory council members. Here in Northern Idaho, we have six people who've really committed to spending a lot of time working on this and have a lot of knowledge and understanding. And also really the value of the advisory council is that Brad provides a lot of local knowledge that I just can't have for 1,200 miles of trail. So he can talk to local folks about local issues in a much more knowledgeable way sometimes than I can. On our website, the Forest Service website, which is fs.fed.us/PNT, has a list of all of our advisory council members and how to contact them. And so that's a good way. And also having a series of meetings along the length of the trail over the next year, which is also a good opportunity.
And probably the key points at which to weigh in is when the Forest Service puts out the draft management plan for the trail. That will have some proposed management direction as well as some of the alternate routes that may be chosen. And then along with that, the environmental impact statement that'll look at, all the effects of the trail, be they recreational, wildlife, or otherwise. And those are really the key points, I think, probably, Matt, don't you, that the public would want to review those documents and the maps and provide their written input.
Yeah, the first document like that will be coming out, our proposed action for the trail, which will be early 2017. But right now, folks have the opportunity to work with me, the Forest Service, and their advisory council members as we're kind of working to tweak that a little bit, figure out where is the best place for the PNT to be in the future. In most places, it's already in the right location. But one of the challenges is figuring out, okay, how do we get it off roads? How do we get it off unsustainable trails? How do we get it out of areas of particularly sensitive wildlife or physical impacts?
So if you move too many sections, someone who's already hiked its length, will they have to do it again?
They may not have to do it again. They may want to do it again.
Good point. We talk a lot about hikers, but the vision for the trail also includes other users. Would you like to talk about that?
The trail by law is non-motorized, which leads to our road challenge. But also it is it's really open to all uses other than motorized use. So historically, many sections of the trail obviously have been hiked. A lot of pack and saddle stock use on the trail and also mountain biking in several areas.
Yeah, I mean, there's interest from what I've been speaking with lots of different people that, everyone wants to, can I take my bike on this section? Could I take my horse all the way across? And it's awesome to see that kind of excitement about it. But there are just like certain local management restrictions, like in the national parks, how you can't have, you can't use your bicycles, you can't bring your dogs. So those are just a few things to think about. So it's kind of looking at local management, but we definitely welcome all non-motorized travel.
Sadly, you're not allowed to ride your horse onto the ferry from Whidbey Island over to the Olympic Peninsula.
Oh, no.
You can put it in a trailer. You can't ride it.
But it sounds like some of the highway sections may be less desirable for the horse.
Correct, yes. Yeah. Really, right now, it's only a feasible end-to-end opportunity for hikers, but we're working on that and hope to make it better for everybody.
So I think we want to talk about the hiking experience. It's springtime. It's the time of year when a lot of folks' fancies turn to thoughts of long trips and other adventures. How many people are doing the Pacific Northwest Trail right now, end to end?
Last year, there were about 40 to 50 people who thru-hiked the trail. When I first started here a few years ago, it was about 8 or 10. So it went from 10 to 15 the next year to 25 the next year, now up to about 50. So it's trying to forecast future use is really one of the interesting challenges we have.
I would think that would be one of the real advantages of hiking this trail, the fact that there's so few people compared to other popular lengthy hikes.
Yeah, that's definitely a number of the people that we've heard back from after having done it. Why did you choose to do this trail? A lot of people were interested in that solitude aspect and also this it just seems more adventurous to them that there's some orienteering involved. You know, there's a lot of looking at maps. It's not like being on the Appalachian Trail and you just see the white blazes and you keep going. It's much more of a choose your own adventure. So there's definitely that aspect that's appealing to people.
And I'll add a personal anecdote here that relates to this question. I actually got a permit this year to do the John Muir Trail in the Sierras. And that is probably one of the more popular trails. For most of its length, it's aligned with the Pacific Crest Trail. But it's become so popular that they deny somewhere in excess of 90% of the permit applications. And I won the lottery this year, so I was pretty happy about that. But I think, you know, as some of these national scenic trails like John Muir and Pacific Crest and Appalachian get really popular and the use is limited by whatever permit systems are in place, people look to other opportunities. And I think the PNT is probably going to be one of those. And so I can only imagine that the use is going to grow.
Yes. I was thinking along those lines about the way the world is changing today. We have climate change. We have a lot of change in terms of the information that we can gather with technology. And it seems to me that that would be an advantage for this trail. How do you all feel about that? How do you see maybe media talking about the trail, technology, and even climate change affecting this trail? I know that's a lot of topics, but we can address maybe one or two.
We could start with the technology, which has really revolutionized outdoor recreation in general. The amount of information available to people is exponentially more than it was even 10 years ago before the internet really blew up. And people were still carrying around a 200-page guidebook in their pack, not even for a long-distance trail, but just probably like walking around the Selkirks, if there even was a hiking guide to the Selkirks back then. And now most folks have their phone, and they're able to bring up maps and figure out exactly where they are. And then kind of one of the more interesting things for me is that they're able to, you know, almost live blog their experience. So while I'm sitting in my office in Everett, Washington one day, I can actually log onto the internet and see what people are doing, where they are on the trail, what they think about it, what sections they like, what sections they don't like. It's really kind of interesting.
It's a resource for you all, isn't it, to have the information coming in?
It's definitely a resource, but I really strongly encourage hikers who are out doing the trail to still be well-versed in the traditional forms of navigation. I mean, you never know when your tablet or your cell phone or your GPS is going to fall in the creek or lose battery life. So having strong map and compass skills and orienteering skills is really important.
So how is social media, you mentioned, how is that changing the hiker's experience? How's that changing patterns of use? What are we seeing as a result?
I think there's, a lot of people, I guess it's partially what I've been hearing back. And those people who are using social media, we are hearing about those things more just because they're accessing the communications platform. So, you know, there's, I think, a lot more selfies involved. a lot of people coming down, you know, down into the towns, and while they're doing their laundry, they're posting their pictures. And I think it, you know, I know there was the one lady last year that I was connected with on Instagram, and I was like, "Oh, you're coming through Whitefish. Like, maybe we could meet up and, you know, take some more selfies before you continue." But she was just posting kind of a little bit behind. But so it was really interesting.
I think one of the ways where the PNT differs from other long distance trails is due to the relatively low levels of use, the lack of community of thru hikers on the trail while they're hiking from end to end. And that's one of the comments we've heard a lot from people, where it's a lot different than the PCT or the AT. Sometimes, you know, 2 years ago, you could thru hike this trail from end to end, and somebody actually did that and didn't see another thru hiker while they were there because they were just a week ahead or a week behind and they didn't cross. And now that use is increasing, that's changing. But also there's a sense of community developing around the trail because of social media. Before folks were even hiking the trail, there are a couple of active Facebook groups where people are talking about the trail, talking about the route selection, talking about issues, challenges, fires. You know, what did you eat when you're on the PNT? I'm planning out my meals for this year. So there's a lot more information, and it really helps people understand. I would say that PNT.org is still the best place to go for up-to-date factual information on the trail.
It's changed a lot. Planning and experiencing a trail the last 15, 20, 25 years has remarkably changed that way. And with the rise of social media, you can feel and experience something that someone else is having in real time. What about sharing afterwards those experiences? Are they still connected in communities? Do these Facebook groups disappear after a year?
Those Facebook groups have been going for a few years, and they keep going. Folks who did thru-hike the trail in the past couple of years stay involved. And then every year there's, you know, 15, 20, 30 new people who join up thinking, I'm going to hike this trail this year. Not everybody actually winds up doing it, but they become part of the community and they say, I can't do it this year, I'm going to do it next year. And they keep it as a goal. So it really develops. One of the other interesting ways that social media has become involved is through trail angels, folks helping out thru-hikers as they work their way from end to end. In some communities, local community sort of follows along and sees, okay, this is when the thru-hikers are going to arrive, say, in Republic, Washington. And so the community there's some folks who go out to the trailhead, pick people up and drive them into town for a burger and some barbecue. So they can follow along, see when those folks are coming, and the community then can work to improve the experience of the thru-hikers because of that social media connection.
I know that also last year when there were all those fires that were starting up, there was a lot of, you know, have you seen this person? Where's the last time you saw this person? So there was this coordination of safety that was going on. That was really a great community aspect to see.
And do you find that the trail angels are growing to the state that they're as known or as useful as they would be on the AT, the Appalachian Trail, or maybe the Pacific Crest Trail, or are they sort of in their infancy still?
I would say that they're in their infancy, but there are some who really rise to that level. There's a trail angel in Medellin Falls, Washington, which is sort of, not quite the halfway point of the trail, but it's sort of the first real go-to place along the trail. And you're guaranteed, you know, early in the summer to see photos of a lot of thru-hikers together in a backyard having beer and talking about their experience and really getting to know this community that ordinarily they would not have the opportunity to enjoy like that.
And it's a two-way street, isn't it? The hikers have to be respectful of the towns, et cetera, in order to continue to have the sharing.
So this is really part of the community portion of the planning or vision or future of the Pacific Northwest Trails. That's something that the advisory committee is looking at?
It is. One of the real strengths of the advisory council, we have 28 people representing 1,200 miles of trail, so we have folks from a lot of the small communities along the way, and so we're working with them to really understand what these communities want, what they need, what do they value about the Pacific Northwest Trail, what do they value about public lands in general, and so working with them to incorporate their vision for the future, not only for this trail, but for all public lands.
Yeah, the community aspect is really come out in the first meeting of the advisory council, and I know in Bonner's Ferry here locally, there's a lot of interest in that. In fact, yesterday we had a small subcommittee meeting to look at the route through Idaho, and there was some talk about the Kootenai tribe might be having or might provide a boat where they could pick people up on the Kootenai River and drive them downstream on the river to the Selkirks to avoid that lengthy road walk. So, you know, it seems like there's definitely increasing interest in the community aspect of the trail.
Well, I think it's time for a little station identification break and maybe even a song, Phil. We'll talk about that later. And just to remember that we are listening to 88.5 KRFY, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho.
That was Nancy Sinatra with a very appropriate song. I don't think the boots were walking all over anyone in the room, hopefully just the trail. We're back talking about the Pacific Northwest Trail with Matt McGrath, the Forest Service Manager for the trail, with Brad Smith, who's a member of the advisory committee here in North Idaho, and Stephanie Campbell from the Pacific Northwest Trail Association. We've got a lot more to talk about. Time is limited, so we'll kind of jump into some of the most pressing topics. You mentioned permits earlier. Does a person need a permit to hike through the trail, and how do they get one?
The person doesn't need a permit to hike the trail. There are certain sections of the trail in our three national parks, Glacier, North Cascades, and Olympic, where backcountry permits are required. We're not at the point yet, like the Pacific Crest Trail, where there is an end-to-end permit that folks can get.
Good. And so where do they go to get that trail again, or the permit again?
The permits actually is one of the, I'd say, one of the small challenges that we're working on, and we'll work with the advisory council on that. Right now, the thru-hiker would have to get a permit from each of the three parks. So it can be a little bit of a challenge when you're coming through the Pusaten Wilderness in central Washington. It's about a 10-day hitch, and then you just pop out into North Cascades National Park, and you're supposed to have a permit. So how do you do that when you're in Oroville, Washington, and you say, I think it'll take 9 days to get there, but what if it takes me 10? What if I really have a great time at Cathedral Pass and it takes me 11? So that's one of the challenges, figuring out how we can make the thru-hiker experience a little more seamless and a little less bureaucratic.
So off the future, it'll be greatly simplified. Or at least simplified, if not greatly so.
We'll be working towards that, yes.
This is really where a lot of the times partner groups come into play and help to manage those experiences or planning processes. And right now, I believe the Pacific Northwest Trail Association has a lot of resources. Do you want to talk some, Stephanie, about the planning and other resources that the PNTA has?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now we're kind of gathering, as we're continuing to work on gathering all those materials. We are kind of letting those who have done the trail do a lot of the kind of gathering together and kind of creating that meeting space. So we have pnt.org/forum, which is our like official forum for people to go and, you know, post about specific topics, have a specific question, and, you know, there's like a whole history of things there. So, you know, you can go back, you know, to different seasons and see, you know, what recommendations were in the past and be able to, you know, kind of plan from there. There's also, we just have a lot of great volunteers. So we also have the digest. We also have a data book that Tim Youngbluth puts out every year. We also have a trail town guide that Melanie Zimmerman puts out. So we have a lot of really great people involved in putting information out there. And then, as we were talking about before, social media has really come into play in recent years. So there's a number of a couple of main Facebook groups where people are, you know, talking to each other and planning. So it's a lot of informal, you know, community kind of crowdsourcing information up to this point. And so now we're trying to compile all of that into, you know, more onto like the main portion of the website. But mostly the pnt.org/forum is kind of the main place to go.
And for those folks who are old fashioned and want to open up a book at night and read about it, is there a place where they can order something like that?
Yeah, so for there's a number of books that are available on like Amazon mostly. So the Tim Youngbluth, the Trail Digest and the Data Book, Melanie Zimmerman's Trail Town Guide, and then also Ron Strickland has that, you know, founder's perspective of the trail. That's really valuable as well. Mm-hmm. You can get all those on Amazon.
What time of year are most people walking in? What direction are they walking in, and where do they jump on?
So because of the how high the trail is, the beautiful you know, alpine scenic aspects that we have, there's a lot of passes that are pretty high that need to melt off before people want to attempt to cross those. So the season for the trail is about 3 months from basically the end of June to the end of September. And that's great because that's about how much time it takes to complete the trail. The 1,200 miles, 3 months is about the average. So people generally start on the east side, right at the kind of the east part of Glacier and the Belly River, and then they head west, and that's due to the passes that they want to get over in Glacier, because they get a little bit more leeway on the west end in the Olympics, and then you go all the way to the coast.
Could they start at the middle and work to one end and then flip-flop?
I mean, I think that, you know, anybody out there who's dedicated enough, who has the skills, could flip flop, shim sham, I don't know, whatever you want to say. Yeah, I think people can do that. And there's also, you know, there's no reason that you have to be a through hiker either for this trail. I mean, there's, you can take a section, you know, you're like, I just want to do the Passaitan Wilderness. I'm a wilderness buff. That's what I want to do. And I want to combine my love for the Pacific Northwest Trail. You can just do that section, or you could do a section that's much closer to town, you know, and go by Bonner's Ferry to Republic. And then there's also just day hikes. You know, a lot of people are already doing that and they don't even realize that they're hiking on the Pacific Northwest Trail. And
so if someone only had a week and wanted to, say, do a highlight of the trail, maybe what are the top three or four places they might choose to go?
Well, I definitely have a local bias for the Selkirks, but in addition, you know, I've always been very fond of the North Cascades. I think that the North Cascades and also Glacier are just some of the most spectacular scenery that we have here in the Pacific Northwest. And those also happen to be the sections with the least amount of road walking. So, you know, I think it's probably safe to say those sections of the trail are well established and ready to use. And that's probably where you're going to have the most, like a wilderness quality experience.
One of the really interesting things about the PNT is the variety of the experience available. And so a lot of times, you know, I agree with Brad and Stephanie. Those are the first places that come to mind when I think of hiking the trail is North Cascades or Glacier. Olympic National Park also, and people think of the Olympic Mountains and the rainforest, which is something. But then they a lot of times don't think about the Olympic Coast. The PNT finishes on the Olympic Coast with about a 25-mile hike right there on the beach up to Cape Alava. So we have all these different experiences available. So if you have just a few days or a week, you can do a series of different short trips on the PNT and see something different every time.
So there's a little something for everybody.
Makes it very unique. It sounds like a great trail to think about doing parts of. And another interesting aspect is that one could take the train and begin from Glacier. That would be a fun way to start a hiking trip.
A lot of people do start that way.
I would think so. Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Morning Show on 88.5 KRFY. We're here today talking about the Pacific Northwest Trail. One of our guests has to leave, I think, to go start a trail somewhere pretty soon. Any parting thoughts, Brad?
Well, I just really appreciate the opportunity to be a guest on the show today. I'm a hiker myself. I got into hiking when I was in high school, and you know, I spent all kinds of time in the Selkirks. I saw caribou up in the Selkirks, and it was really through my hiking experience that I came to find conservation and want to pursue a career in conservation. So I'm a lover of hiking. I'm a lover of wildlife and conservation, and I just think it's really great that we're going to have our own National Scenic Trail coming through Idaho.
You know, some very inspiring terrain, and of course the trail itself is an added layer of inspiration.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us today, Brad.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Let's shift gears and talk about volunteers. There sounds like a lot of work to be done to move this trail from roads or highways to trail. How does that get built?
There is, with the 1,200-mile trail, even if it's only 900 miles of actual trail right now, there is a lot of work to be done, and you know, facing facts that there are declining budgets for federal land management agencies and for trail work. So really, we rely on volunteers to do a lot of the trail work, and we rely on our primary partner, the Pacific Northwest Trail Association, to lead a lot of that work for us.
Yeah, so we, you know, there's a lot that we have a little bit more flexibility to do than the federal government. And it, you know, it makes sense for us to kind of spread out along the trail as we are. We have our main office in Cedro Woolley, Washington, Western Washington. And then we have my satellite office out in Whitefish. And so we're able to, you know, spread out and, you know, meet with other volunteer groups as well and to kind of put our efforts together. You know, we have all these common interest things that we love, you know, the backcountry horsemen of America, Montana Conservation Corps, these organizations that are already involved in that really hard on the ground work of taking care of these beautiful public lands that we love. And so we work with those organizations to say, here's the Pacific Northwest Trail, just one more amazing thing that our region has that we can work together to take care of. So we are happy to help the Forest Service in service of that.
Forest Service is pretty fortunate. A lot of times we have more volunteers than we can handle. People don't realize that it actually takes a lot of staff time to manage a volunteer project. One of the great aspects of our partnership with the Pacific Northwest Trail Association is that they help bridge that gap. A lot of times there would be volunteer projects that wouldn't happen, but folks like Stephanie are able to step in and connect volunteers to work that needs to be done, get the tools and equipment that need to be done, and make it happen.
And that work's been going on a long time before this designation by Congress in 2009. The Pacific Northwest Trail Association's been around for a while?
Yeah, so the founder, the visionary of the Pacific Northwest National Scenic Trail and the Pacific Northwest Trail Association, Ron Strickland, started coming up with this idea back in 1970, but it wasn't until 1977 that the Pacific Northwest Trail Association was formed. So that's kind of, we were incorporated as a nonprofit, but it was very volunteer-driven for a long, long time, as these trail efforts generally are. I mean, Vermont Long Trail and Appalachian Trail both have the, Pacific Crest Trail. They all have the same history of volunteers stepping up and stepping into these roles. Our association is no different. We've been around trying to, mobilize people on the ground toward these efforts, working from, getting the counties involved, the localities, municipalities, and then the states involved, getting national recreation trail designations for certain portions of the trail. All of those efforts finally coalesced in 2009, led by John Knechtel, our director of trail operations at the time, really spearheaded the effort and finally got it designated in an omnibus public lands bill.
And so how did that change things for your organization, for the volunteer effort? What did that bring to the table?
Resources. With that congressional designation, it says this is something that the people of our nation want. It's something that we can all get behind. And with that designation, I mean, Matt could speak more to this, but it comes with, the trail administrator, which is Matt's role, but, as a part of the Forest Service. And so there are dollars attached to that, that designation and that effort to coordinate. Because, once you have that designation, there are certain standards that the trail has to reach. And so we have to move toward that. And 1,200 miles is a lot of miles to move toward that with.
I think for PNTA, what changed the most with designation of the trail is the mission or the focus of the organization. For many years in the mid-2000s, they were focused on getting the trail designated as a National Scenic Trail, providing that long-term protection for the PNT. Then in 2009, that happened. So then, okay, well, we got our big project. We got it done. What do we do now? And that was when they started to transition more. They were only doing volunteer projects and trail construction work, but really the focus now, volunteers and trail construction work, and also connecting kids and communities to their public lands.
Yeah, exactly. It's just understanding that, now we're kind of trying to do what we could, and now we actually have the resources to move toward sort of that promotion and protection goal.
It seems to me that we need a visionary person to imagine the trail and start walking it, and then as it grows and it becomes something more and you have funds, you continue to need a visionary to see its future and use the resources. Do you feel like that's going as you would like for it to?
I think so. I definitely agree with needing a visionary at the beginning. And Ron Strickland, kind of the founder, had the big idea in 1970, is really one of those people I admire because of his ability to be such a visionary. To see that, it was 1970, there were really not that many people hiking in the Pacific Northwest back then around Glacier and northern Idaho, but to realize that we needed to do something to provide this opportunity and to protect this experience. That was really an incredible amount of foresight on his part. And now I think I also agree with you that we still need that. And that is one of the great strengths of our advisory council, is that bringing all of these people together with a varied perspective and working together and talking about, okay, what's important about this trail? What do we want to do? Coming up with ideas together, and much stronger ideas as a group rather than just relying on an individual.
So what's the timeline look like to complete the planning process you're engaged in now and to actually build or rebuild or reroute almost 1,200 miles of trail or significant portions of that 1,200 miles?
So to answer the boring question first about planning, we're just getting started on our comprehensive plan and we're scheduled to finish around 2019, which is about par for the course for the federal government. One of the big parts of that plan is to kind of finalize the location of the trail. Congress approved a route in 2009. In a lot of areas, it's great and doesn't need to be looked at. In a lot of areas, in those 300 miles of roads especially, we need to do something to get it off. So working on this plan is kind of identifying, okay, how do we get this trail off of these roads, or if there's a section like Brad was mentioning where there's just the section with no trail, how do we put a trail in there or some other way make that connection? So that's ongoing. We're identifying those areas, but we already know there are areas where it's a road, we need to get the trail off the road. So working with local offices, working with partners like PNTA and Stephanie to identify those and start working on those immediately and not just wait for the plan.
And before it's built out, I know last summer I was on a trail project with a young woman in her early 20s, and she commented she was building this not for herself, but for her children. Are we looking at that distant a line into the future before the trail's complete? Is it our children or our children's children?
I don't think we're looking that far out before the trail is complete. That's a tough question to know exactly when it'll get done. But it's a great sentiment that person is sharing, and that goes to a lot of the work that PNTA is doing to get kids outside, not only now, but working towards that in the future.
We have just a few more minutes before we wrap up, though. One more time about where folks can go for more information about the trail in general and more information about resources on planning a hike.
Yeah, so if if this has inspired you to check it out and learn more, you can do that at pnt.org. That's the association's website, and we have a lot of great resources available there, maps, interactive maps, strip maps, different kinds of maps. and then also pnt.org/forum is the place to go if you want that interactive experience of working with people who have already done the trail and kind of crowdsourcing some information there.
And if we want an inspirational story or some photos from previous hikers, there's Facebook. Are there other places to go?
Yeah. There's Facebook, absolutely. And then there's some really incredible people who have done the trail and have created some awesome videos and blogs and things about that. And our communications director, Sam, has really done a great job of putting a lot of those up on our blog and featuring them. So if you go through our blog role on PNT.org, you'll also be able to find features of a lot of those incredible people.
Mm-hmm. Also available on PNT.org are a lot of stories about the advisory council members, getting to know those people better than you can just from the Forest Service website of Brad Smith, Idaho Conservation League. If you go to PNT.org, there'll be stories, and so folks can get to know their advisory council members from their area and be able to make a better personal connection. In general, I'd say almost always PNT.org is the place to go for the most up-to-date information. We'll give you one other website, the Forest Service website for planning information. Is fs.fed.us/PNT. And that's going to have all the planning information, everything we're working on with the advisory council and the small groups will be up there for people to view and comment on.
It takes a real community to build a trail, to experience the trail, to keep that experience alive. We appreciate you coming into the studio today. Any last minute parting thoughts?
No, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to talk about this great resource we have here.
Are those hiking boots you're lacing up there, Matt? Are you planning on getting out in the spring weather here?
There's no way I'm not getting out today.
There you go.
Very nice.
And just a reminder that we've been listening to Brad Smith, the North Idaho director for the ICL, Matt McGrath, Pacific Northwest National Scenic Trail Program, and Stephanie Campbell, regional coordinator for the Idaho and Montana region for Pacific Northwest Trail Association. She's from Whitefish. Thank you.
thank you all for coming in. And Julie, do you have any hiking plans for this weekend? The weather's going
to
hold.
Actually, Phil, I do, because as you know, my husband is planning to begin the Pacific Crest Trail at the end of April. And so he's been hiking his legs off. And of course, I get dragged along with that.
What are some of his favorite training hikes?
Oh, my. He is all over the place. He does like Harrison Lake. He's been out to Round Lake a bunch because it's near our house. That's an easy little 3-mile walk. I've got a whole list we could talk about, but I know time is short.
Well, we can keep that list for the future. What other things are happening this weekend? What's coming up besides April Fool's Day?
Well, that's right. We have a few items coming up, one of which is on Saturday, the 2nd, we have the Street Scramble. That's Eastern Washington Orienteering Club sponsoring a street scramble. That's starting at 10:15 a.m. in Sandpoint at the West Athletic Club. It's 1905 Pine Street. That is going to allow you to bike or run as many as 40 map points in 3 hours and work on your navigation skills, which would be something it sounds like you would want to have if you're going to be hiking the PNT.
That might be a great training regimen for your husband. Is he signed up?
He's not, but I think he will be when I get home, Phil. And another interesting thing a person might want to take in on Saturday again would be the first Saturday at the museum. If you haven't been in, the Bonner County Historical Museum at 611 South Ella has a free first Saturday every month. So that's worth a trip and free. And there are a bunch of things, but we'll mention one more. Let's get away from the second, though. Let's move on to the Eddie the Eagle, the 1st through the 3rd at the Panada. You can watch that. They'll be hosting a screening of the film Eddie the Eagle at 7:30 p.m. on the 1st and 2nd and at 3:30 on the 3rd. It was inspired by true events. Ski jumper.
Thank you, Julie. We hope you enjoyed today's show. We have more guests next week. Julie and I will be returning on Tuesday, April 5th, and in the studio with us will be Aaron Mader from the Lakes Commission talking about a variety of topics. I believe they're meeting today in their quarterly forum. A lot of things happening with the lake this time of year, from flowering rush pools to the monitoring of the lake levels. And she'll have news to report to us from this week's activities and what to expect in the coming future. And then this weekend, Deb and I are planting the garden, at least some of it, some lettuce and chard and other early season things. And I believe Garden Talk is returning on April 12th with you and Susie.
We'll check the date, but it's likely.
Yeah. Are you planting anything in your garden this season?
Oh, Phil, I'm getting going. I've got some things planted in the house, and I've been moving fruit trees around. So we'll see what happens with all of those.
Yeah.
You're planting your garden. That's great.
Well, we've turned some soil. We've gotten things going. We're making things happen so that we can get to the planting. And this has been a nice spring break. We were looking at it last weekend, but then snow fell, and we thought maybe we would wait another week or two.
Smart.
But
well,
we also...
Oh, you go ahead.
Should
Phil.
We what? Go ahead.
I was going to say we'll wrap it up with a song, but you've got
not
something.
Not quite ready yet, Julie.
So. All right. I'm pushing the songs today, aren't I? I better slow down.
So we have an important event, an exciting event coming up in May to benefit KRFY. The Little Smokies Band's returning. A lot of folks were jamming out to that music back in the winter. We're coming back with the Little Smokies, fresh off their win at the Telluride Bluegrass Band Festival, May 6th, to the Panada Theater. They'll be performing a KRFY Community Radio Benefit Concert. So save the date, May 6th. Get your tickets now at Evans Brothers Coffee, Pedro's, Ike Arts, KRFY. You can call the studio here to arrange for tickets at 265-2992, or you can go online at panada.org. That's the Little Smokies, along with their special guest, Doug Bond and Terry Ludeker, Friday, May 6th at the Panada, a KRFY Benefit Concert. We're going to go out and close the hour with the number one song from 1984. It started an 11-week run, and I think it's appropriate, too, to today's topic, Kenny Loggins, Footloose.